Hi, this is Bill Rundle, host of My Quest for the Best, where we meet business, thought, and community leaders to discuss issues relevant to entrepreneurial growth. Joining me today is Fred Welk. Fred's an attorney who represents people and companies for technology and intellectual property issues. Briefly working as a programmer during college, Fred used that experience as a spur to investigate the intersection of technology, intellectual property, and business over the last 30 years. About half of Fred's experience has been in large law firms, while the other half has been in small boutique firms, including his current practice, WilkTech LLC. For some companies, Fred's the outside general counsel helping with any and all legal issues that may arise. And for other companies, especially larger ones, Fred focuses on particular types of technology agreements and consulting. In addition, Fred writes, speaks, and teaches on topics of technology law and provides pro bono legal services to charities and other nonprofits. Welcome, Fred.
Thank you for inviting me, Bill.
You've been a part of so many fascinating things, but before we get into it, fill in a few details around the professional bio to help people get to know you a little better.
Sure. Well, let's see, I've been practicing law for 30-plus years now, but before that, as you mentioned, I was a programmer briefly in college. I joke that at this point I probably spend more time telling people I was a programmer than the time that I actually spent writing code. But that was late 70s, the mainframe days. Mostly I was working on financial applications, the little company, little conglomerate, then known as RCA. That was all mainframe financial applications that later were replaced with this newfangled thing called Lotus 1-2-3 and a couple of macros.
How about that? Did you have an early inspiration to help you get interested in technology and or law? Was there someone in your family or neighbor growing up that somehow helped you make that connection?
Well, it wasn't so much individuals as a number of things that were available to me at the time, I think that I saw certainly growing up. One was growing up late 60s and 70s, Vietnam War was raging, so it was very much a living room war because you turn on the television and the war was right there. So policy was always something that interested me in terms of how the policies chosen by governments and by people affected others. And in many ways, long-term policy decisions would lead to short-term life and death decisions. I mean, that's all you can look at the history of Vietnam and how it got into the war, and it's something I found very interesting, especially living through it on a day-to-day basis and how each government, the U.S. and Vietnam and other governments in the world, reacted to that. So it was very much a global issue to me in some regards that had local effects. And that fascinated me from a young age. Technology itself began to integrate early on. I was always a bit of a tinkerer and was known for pulling stuff apart from an early age. So, I mean, at one point, I somehow got hold of a neighbor's high technology radio. And at the age of 4 or 5, I just pulled it apart and found the whole thing fascinating. The adults didn't know what to do with it. They couldn't put it back together again. So finally gave it back to me, asked me to put it together again, and I did so, and it worked. So that got me started on technology.
And literally, the light bulbs went on. Both
literally,
the
light bulbs went on.
Perhaps the tubes.
Yeah, it was an early solid-state radio. It was great. The computer specifically were not available to me in high school. We did have programmable calculators. They had a programmable calculator, probably about 2 feet by 2 feet large, made by Burroughs that took little magnetic cards for programming. I used that in high school. A couple of friends of mine were into computer programming, and as we got into college, I started taking all the computer programming courses then available and took a few additional courses or made up a few additional courses as for additional credit. I just worked with a couple of professors and made up a few courses. The best part about that is that my high school buddies were then working for RCA. They needed help with financial applications. They didn't have enough programmers at the time. This is circa 1979. So they invited me to come work at RCA for a couple summers. And that was wonderful. By the time I got to law school in the early 80s, I would talk about computers, and at that point, it was a complete disconnect. People understand why a lawyer would have any interest in computers. So it seemed like a wide open field to me. I immediately jumped into that. I've been practicing since 85 at both big firms and law firms, big firms and small firms, and it's been wonderful. No shortage of issues, no shortage of work.
So describe your ideal client.
There are several profiles for my ideal client. One profile is a funded startup. They have some money. They're able to carry out their strategy. They're moving towards sales and revenue positive as quickly as possible. Those are the companies I can be an outside general counsel for, or if they already have a general counsel, I can help them with any technology-specific issues or intellectual property issues that may arise. Other clients that I have are medium-sized businesses, same or similar approach, again, general counsel or more specific. For the larger companies, and I work with a number of Fortune 500s, I tend to be more specific as to their needs, filling in where they don't already have somebody in-house or outside, such as technology questions that come up or intellectual property questions, specific types of agreements, whatever they may need fits in my particular skill set. Mostly deep into the technology, deep into intellectual property.
So give us an example of a client you've worked with that really had no other place to go, and you were able to bring to bear some of the understanding you have, the connections and skills to help them navigate a very murky and risky area.
Certainly. There's one company, for example, that was based both in the U.S. and in England and the United Kingdom. In that case, out of London, they were trying to build and have since built a healthcare-related portal for a particular disease. And one of the problems they ran into is that they wanted to open both in U.S. and in the European Union, which Great Britain is part of, but they had to comply
with
essentially lots of different laws. So by the time I was done, I was outside general counsel for part of it. I was technology counsel after they got it. At an in-house general counsel. But for the most part, what I did was to help them with privacy issues, with copyright issues, with some understanding of whether or not they might or might not have a patent that might be worth pursuing, although I don't file patent applications myself. But in each case, I did one of two things. Either I did the work myself, if it was within my ability work, something that I do on a regular basis, such as contracts, trademarks, copyrights, day-to-day issues, or I brought in a specialist. So, for example, I helped out with the privacy policies and discussion of U.S. privacy law versus EU privacy law, and then I brought in an attorney in London to help specifically with European Union privacy issues. I was able to help that startup get the best bang for the buck, including helping identify what they did and did not have to do. So, Bill, there are two ways I can help with clients. One is I help directly with my skill set, especially technology and intellectual property issues. The other approach is I build teams, sometimes on an ad hoc basis, making sure that we bring in the right people with the right experience and expertise to address the issues that are before us and make sure they get solved in a cost-effective way.
So what is an area today that people have a huge misunderstanding of, or their information is outdated as to how something operates, that business people who are running businesses probably need to be aware of because they're on riskier ground than they might initially realize?
Unfortunately, there are several areas where that's true. Intellectual property is still very difficult because it's not a single area of law. It's actually a category of several different areas of law, patent law being different from trademark, being different from copyright law, being different from trade secret law, and so on. So there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of confusion there, in part because some of the concepts are similar, almost all the processes are different. It gets very confusing, and unfortunately, the state legislatures and Congress don't always make it easy. They do a lot of non-intuitive things. Another area that's very important to know for any business that's still a little difficult is privacy. And it's the same kind of issue. Privacy law is pretty much has the same foundation from country to country, from state to state, but implemented in a very different manner from state to state and from country to country. And most people don't know when they first get into this how to navigate all those different changes. And some of the information online is helpful and some of it isn't.
So let's get into an example. Recently, Uber got called out because they were using people's data and selling that data separately in a way that the customers weren't quite clear on, and there was quite a backlash. You're familiar with that?
Absolutely.
Can you describe it from a legal perspective and what they missed as the managers running the business and what consumers need to be more aware of in order to be better educated?
One of the principles in privacy law is that a company or entity that controls individuals' personal information must explain to those individuals exactly how that information is being used, processed, and stored, and whether it's being shared with others and how it's being shared with others. It's very much a matter of transparency. It's a fundamental issue in privacy law. And Uber did not act in a transparent manner. In many cases where a company is looking at ways they can use all this wonderful information getting from users, they go ahead and do it without thinking about communicating what they're doing to their users, and that lack of transparency that gets them into trouble, even where the process that they choose or how they use the data is not a breach of any law. They fail to properly explain that in a privacy policy or statement to the public, that can create problems for the company. And that's what happened with Uber.
So would they just have had to update their privacy policy? Because I think people, a lot of times, take myself for instance, I signed up for Uber, I signed up for Lyft, and you know you can't get to what you need to unless you just click that you've read and accepted the privacy policy. And I haven't read those privacy policies carefully. I needed to get a ride. So I clicked the checkbox and got to get my ride. That was the solution I needed to solve at that time, and really haven't circled back in order to read and make sure that the way that they're using the information I've shared with them is something I'm okay with, because I've already accepted, I've already used the service. And I think a lot of people are in that same boat. We almost become desensitized to accepting the privacy end user agreements just because they're put in front of us so often. So what do we need to do as users, and what could Uber managers have done differently in order to come out of this in a more transparent and respected way?
All good questions. Users certainly educate themselves and have a better understanding of how their data is being used. And maybe that will change who they share data with, and maybe it won't, frankly. Because, as you said, for the most part, most consumers don't bother to read the contracts. And the businesses understand that, the lawyers understand that, the regulators understand that. They're trying to make it as easy as possible so that any individual who wants to read the documents can do so and can understand how the data is being used and can decide whether or not to share that data. So the transparency is there not because all the consumers will use it. For the most part, the consumers won't. The transparency is required for those users who want to control how their data is being used. What gets some businesses in trouble, and I think is what happened with Uber, is they assume that because most users don't bother, that they won't care. That's a mistake in a couple levels. One, some users do care. That may not be a large percentage, but it's certainly a very vocal percentage. And second, the regulators very much care because it's their duty to enforce the law, whether or not the consumers are following what the company's doing with the data or not. So for those consumers who are interested in how the data is being used, and they may not care until one day they find out that there's been a breach and suddenly some bad guy has access to the data, or they may find out that the data has been shared without a breach, but with some other company that perhaps the individual does not want his or her data shared with. And at that point, they get a little upset. At that point, maybe they will begin reading some of these documents, and maybe not. The key is that the law is there for those who want to use it, and the regulators will enforce it. That's their job. Whether or not the companies understand that, that's part of my duties to explain to my clients what they're required to do, what the law requires them to do, and what the law does not require them to do. I think
Sure. Two big cases in point would be Target which had those two breaches, at least two breaches that were very public, where consumers' data and possibly credit card numbers were exposed, and it was in the millions of records. And then Yahoo also had that. The same thing happened prior to their purchase from Verizon. It affected their stock, the stock purchase price, and it seems like, you know, these are really serious issues because people react to it. So are there lessons to be learned from those? And what do you think about the mechanism that we're currently using, that's a checkbox? Is that the right mechanism based upon what you see the best way to protect? I know that you protect the companies, but from a consumer standpoint, is there some other model that you've seen that might be a better model to use?
That's a really good question. And that gets into a lot of different issues, including what the policy should be, what the law should be, and what businesses and consumers should expect from each other. So those are excellent questions. In the case of Target, because I remember reading most about Target, part of that was a professional, you think of it as a professional hit. You had some experienced bad guys. They created some technology at point of sale in part, so they were able to hack in to the Target systems by using some hardware that they put at point of sale. And then later on, they were able to follow that up and get into the Target systems and capture even more data beyond what they could capture at point of sale. So that was very much dealing with professional bad guys. And there's not a huge amount that could have been prevented at that time with that technology. Certainly, you can go back and look at things that Target should have done. I think at least one or two C-level executives at Target got canned for not anticipating that kind of attack. And certainly, the bad guys have a lot of things going for them right now, not the least of which is that a lot of the technology is built and designed without privacy in mind, without security in mind specifically. So the bad guys only have to find one weakness that they can then exploit. So one aspect that needs to change is that businesses need to use as much security as they can afford, or put into the business plan a reasonable amount of security, not because it looks good or seems helpful, but it's necessary because the bad guys really are out there. It's not paranoia. They really are out to get you. Another aspect is that consumers need to understand that some of these attacks can be prevented. Some of these attacks, including the Target one, I'm not sure they could have been prevented, really. Yes, in hindsight, Target could have done a better job with security. But when the professionals are trying to get personal information, it's a lot more difficult to keep them out. Not impossible, but a lot more difficult. And third, on the policy issue, what should happen in those cases? Well, the reason why we know about the Target case, and this is an interesting aspect of policy, is that we now have a series of laws called data breach notification laws where Target or any other company who's breached is required to notify all the people whose information is in the database that was hacked. That's only been true for a couple years. Before that, if somebody had hacked, some bad guy had hacked a database with personal information, the company was not required to notify everybody whose information was hacked. It's because initially California, I think, passed a law that says in case any database containing information about California residents or California employees, state employees, is hacked, you must notify everybody in that database. At that point, notifications began to go out. Notifications began to hit television and radio and the media, and became more available to consumers. Came up on everybody's radar. If it wasn't for that change in policy, I'm not sure we'd have as much interest in privacy or security as we do today.
You know, what's interesting, Fred, is it seems like that goes right back to how we first started off with you talking about the Vietnam War being a living room war, where the policy was in front of people. We had to confront it. We had to think about how that mattered to us, how those choices were affecting people's lives. And here we have a parallel with this data breach notification law where it could have just been swept under the rug, but now it's in front of us. When it gets sent out, it makes it on the TV news. It makes it on the headlines of papers and in our news feeds. that really is a catalyst to helping people become more aware of the risks of privacy policy, don't you think?
Absolutely. And that's where we are right now with privacy law, and it continues to change as we go forward. Right now, for example, U.S. privacy law is, well, the legal term is sectoral, which means that each law affects a different sector. So we have one privacy law for medicine, healthcare issues, such which is called HIPAA, Health Information Portability and Accountability Act, going back, I think, to 1996. We have another set of laws involving financial information, going back to the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which I believe is 1972, 1974. But we don't have a single overarching approach to privacy. Compare that to the European Union, where there's a single overarching approach that's called a privacy directive, technically the Data Protection Act of 1995, that's about to be replaced by a new law called the General Data Protection Regulation, which is even more stringent and creates a single law for all of the European Union regarding privacy and states exactly how all personal information in a database or transmitted electronically or by other means, including hard copy, so that all personal information is addressed by one set of laws. It's a very different approach from region to region. And then you have other areas as well, such as Canada, where they have it somewhere. They're a little less stringent than the European Union, but more stringent than the U.S. In the Canadian law. And you also have different laws in different regions. It gets, on the one hand, it's a higher cost for businesses that do business internationally that have personal information people who live in different regions. It also is difficult because the laws don't really, they really clash a little bit right now. So, for example, some of the laws look at who the data subject is and where that person lives. If the person whose information who we call that a data subject, which frankly is not a nice term, it's just almost a dehumanizing term, but it's a term that we're stuck with right now that the individuals refer to as a data subject. But regardless, if the data subject is in California, then California law applies. But if that information about that California resident is sitting on a server physically located in Pennsylvania, then Pennsylvania law applies as well. If a copy of the data ends up on a server in Ireland, then European Union law applies, and it gets very interesting that way. And then if another copy is made and ends up somewhere in the Pacific Rim, such as Japan, Thailand, Indonesia, then the laws of those countries apply as well. And the laws don't say the same thing all over. There's no treaty that addresses these issues and harmonizes how we deal with this data. I don't see that happening anytime soon, but we might see some harmonization of privacy laws maybe over the next couple of decades. I have to say maybe because I'm not seeing enough of a movement yet that is effective.
So really what it will take is some case that has such major impact that people finally come together from different countries and say, what do we figure out if we could create a document that serves all of our joint interests? And that will take years, I'm sure, to hammer out. But it will really take some sort of crisis to bring us to that point because it's not a high-priority issue right now, is it?
No, it's not a high-priority issue. I think part of it is that different governments in different countries have a very different view on privacy. It's a good policy discussion, certainly. What should be done? What are the costs of it? Because there's no question about it, the more stringent that privacy law is, on average, it's more expensive to implement those laws to the business that has to implement them. I say on average.
Sure. Just remember what it was like with software privacy, and U.S. companies were losing, you know, untold millions when software would be pirated. And
Absolutely.
U.S. reached out to other countries in order to strengthen that, in order to have better trade relations.
And the U.S. vendors also found ways from a technical standpoint to better protect their software from being copied. And some of that we see in SaaS as well, software as a service, that it's a little bit easier to control who has access to the software if you have a live connection to each user. So that also affects how the companies, how the vendors do business.
Absolutely. So a lot of it also comes back to if people are being careless and not following smart practices, terrible things can happen. An obvious example, a recent example, was John Podesta clicking a link from an unknown source that allowed hackers to get into the whole Clinton campaign email server.
Absolutely.
And that was, I believe I read it correctly, I don't know for sure, but based on reports that I read, it was due to one person. They tracked it down to Podesta, who had clicked a link, and that had installed software that allowed them access into their email server. These are the kinds of things that happen in much less visible ways in companies every day, isn't it?
It is. And that's also why I referenced that the technology has to change and user habits have to change. Some of the technology needs to be changed so that clicking on a link doesn't activate, or if it does activate any particular program, whether it's in JavaScript or anything else, it's not going to affect the server that's containing personal information. That is a technology issue that needs to be addressed. It's a tech issue that needs to be addressed. And it's an issue that could have been addressed by DNC at the time, but they didn't have everything in place. So because they had a weakness, and that weakness happened to be one that could be exploited, all the Podesta emails ended up in the hands of the bad guys, who promptly shared them. And, you know, say what you will about what the emails did or did not say, the reality is that if the security had been better at DNC, then this wouldn't have happened. But certainly if the technology had been different, where clicking on a link in an email could not open up the private information, the personal information in the database, then we wouldn't be where we are today. Again, these are real-world consequences. Whatever you do with the policy, whatever you do with the technology, this has real-world consequences for users, and in this case, for the country. Again, whether or not you think that the release of the emails affected the results of the election, and a lot of people, and I think right now the consensus probably did to some extent or another, that would not have been a factor with different technology. So the effects are both specific and broad. Specific as
to, so you're saying that the technology could have prevented that risk and ameliorated it if people don't follow the practices. And I would even challenge that we don't do a terribly good job in government sector, private sector, or even public sector, educating and training users how important it is to follow safe email, social media, anything that interacts with the larger internet world. Those practices need to really be higher priority than they are now. That's from my perspective. What's your perspective on that?
I agree with that, but I also point out to the fact that information technology is still relatively immature. I mean that, and in the context of, if you look at how long information technology has been around, depending on whether you take it back to the 1800s or you take it back to ENIAC in the mid-40s, or any other point you want to look at, it's still a relatively new technology compared to other technologies, and still a developing technology. As a result, you have a couple of fallout. You have a couple of things that fall out from that. One is that there's still a huge gap between users of the technology, which today is everybody, and those who understand the technology well. And no amount of education is going to change much of that. What does need to happen is the education needs to continue. Certainly, I'm a very strong believer in education, but there also has to be a clear understanding that most of the users will not understand how the technology works. So because they don't understand how the technology works, it's on the technology professionals to make the technology easier to use and more bulletproof so that somebody who is not an alpha geek who is using the technology, they click on a link, it's not going to lead to a release of personal information. Again, there are some cases where, especially when you have professional bad guys, such as the Target case, where no matter how much you have in terms of good technology, the bad guys will get through. We want to reduce that, of course, as much as possible. We want to prepare for that, defend against it. That's very clear. But we also want to come up with ways that the individual consumers can't hurt themselves, because this is a technology where, as we've seen time and time again, a person unintentionally can hurt himself or herself, and with all the consequences of that, and do so in a particularly nasty way. You have all these cases where hackers have gotten into personal accounts on social media and have revealed all the social media of an individual, whether that's private or not.
This or even took over and misrepresented them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you see it as the role of the technologist playing the cat and mouse game? Because no matter how much harder you make it to break, they'll come up with better breaking techniques. And in order to counter those breaking techniques, you know, like with computer viruses, or even, what was it, the cry again virus, where it became ransomware on a computer? Is that the right name of it?
Yes, I believe so. Yeah, the cry again ransomware. I remember that's a recent case.
I think it's WannaCry. So in the case of the WannaCry,
You're right.
In the case of the WannaCry ransomware, here's an example of the cat and mouse game, where bad guys have developed this virus. It takes over an individual's computer, but an individual has to take certain steps in order to allow that to happen. What do you see as the role of technology companies as well as governments in forming the landscape and the ecosystem of being able to protect against things like that? Because it appeals at different levels. What's your take on that, Fred?
I think the government has shown, perhaps wisely, that it's not very good at defining technology standards. They've mostly left that up to the technology companies and the vendors to set their own standards, usually through standards organizations, SSO, standard settings organizations. I think that's been good because in most cases, you don't want the government to establish a single standard. There have been some cases where I wish they had. For example, electronic health records right now, there may be one or two de facto standards, but it's not a single de jure or standard that has been imposed by government. So where the government can help is certainly to encourage standard settings organizations to come up with standards that improve usability, security, privacy of their systems, and at the same time to encourage transparency, as we see with privacy law. So that has been helpful. There are some cases, certainly, where the government should also encourage new technology. And it's true that directly and indirectly, the government has been, especially the U.S. government, has been instrumental in the creation of what is now the Internet through its many predecessors, including DARPANET and ARPANET. But in terms of creating standards and setting how the technology should work, that has been mostly done where the government, through the government contracting process, says, we want you to build a system for us for particular use, and please build it to these standards for our use. And then those standards either do or do not percolate into the general public. That has been successful. What has not been successful is that some of the pieces, especially of the earlier versions of the Internet, such as DARPA and DARPANET and ARPANET, did not have what some of the vendors now need, which is better security. Because back in the day, DARPANET security was either non-existent, where they were not transmitting particularly sensitive information, or it was a very strong military-grade security that might not be flexible enough for secure, or today secure enough, then was secure enough for vendors to use on a day-to-day basis. So we end up with is a couple of things. One, government, through its contracting process, by buying new technology, can encourage the development of better, stronger, more secure systems by having vendors build it for them, and then allowing the vendors to use that same technology to share it throughout the world and sell it to others. The other thing is to encourage standard settings organizations to come up with ways to make the Internet more secure and personal technology more secure, including all the data that everybody has on their smartphones.
That is a lot to think about, and it's important for people to be educated and aware of that. What would you say are a couple sources that people ought to add to their reading list to stay more aware of these issues, Fred?
Well, right now, certainly you can look at my website, which is wilftech.com, W-I-L-F-T-E-K.com. I do have some good information, including a couple of videos on the basics of intellectual property. In addition to that, but I don't right now have as many references perhaps as they should, I'll recommend two or three sites, though, in addition to that. One is for intellectual property. There is the USPTO.gov website, which is U.S. Patent and Trademark Office.gov, not .com. Similarly, for copyright issues, copyright.gov, not .com. And for privacy, probably FTC, Federal Trade Commission.gov. In addition, see what else. There also for privacy, what I'll recommend is an international organization called the International Association of Privacy Professionals at IAPP.org. I'm a member of that organization. They have an incredible amount of information, some of which is available only to members, but a great deal is available to anyone who visits without having to go through a paywall. So it's also a good resource.
Well, Fred, you've given us so many things to think about and understand more deeply about the risks and opportunities with privacy, technology, and the way that our data is used and can be used. You mentioned before, just highlight again where people can find you and what should we be thinking about in the near future in order to run businesses with better policies for privacy and security, as well as to be better consumers in that respect.
Certainly. My website is at wilftech.com, W-I-L-F-T-E-K.com. And I think what business should be thinking about is what is coming down the road, as well as what is here today in terms of laws and regulations they are required to live by, with a particular focus on where they are based. Because these laws do change dramatically, whether you're talking about a particular state in the U.S. or whether they have clients outside the U.S. in the European Union or in South America or in different parts of the Asian continent. You need to understand, one, where laws of where that business is based, two, laws of where the customers are based, and three, the law of where the servers are based, where the company has its data, which is why I always recommend to businesses in startup mode and growing businesses that they keep all their data near them. Say a U.S.-based business has all of its data physically located on servers in the U.S. so they are able to comply with multiple different laws or sets of laws in multiple different jurisdictions. Beyond that, I think there is a tremendous amount of great information on how to build and grow a business online, including, of course, your site and this particular podcast. And I think that it's very helpful to growing businesses.
Thank you. Well, Fred, thank you so much for joining us on My Quest for the Best.
Thank you, Bill.